This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The animals genetically closest to humans, chimps and bonobos, also express a lot of the same emotions we do, according to my guest Frans de Waal. He's been accused of anthropomorphism, attributing the characteristics of humans to animals. But his research has convinced a lot of skeptics that animals do express emotions similar to ours. He's been studying primate behavior and emotions for 40 years. His primate research is observational and non-invasive. He began his research in the Netherlands, where he was born and grew up. He's now the director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center near Atlanta, where his office window looks out into the colony of chimps whose behavior he studies. He's also a professor at Emory University and a longtime board member of Chimp Haven in Louisiana, the world's largest facility for chimps who are retired from being used for lab research. His new book is called Mama's Last Hug: Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Frans de Waal, welcome to Fresh Air. You keep offering evidence that primates have emotions, like humans have emotions. And that might seem obvious to many people now, but it wasn't obvious when you were starting out studying primates. What were you told when you started out about primate emotions?
We were told not to talk about them because they were considered by many scientists as inner states, and you only were allowed to talk about outer states. So you talk about the things that you can see, and emotions they feel are assumptions about feelings and stuff like that, and actually thoughts also. So thoughts and feelings, the mental processes basically, were off limits, which is sort of curious because Darwin already talked about the emotions in man and animals, and so Darwin was allowed to talk about it, and then we got this dark period in which we were told, as a student, I was told not to speak about these things.
So the most poignant example of primate emotions that I've ever seen is the video from which your book takes its title, Mama's Last Hug. And this is basically a deathbed visit to a 50-something chimp named Mama, who was the alpha female of the chimp colony at the Burger Zoo, where primates were being studied. And the visitor was your mentor, Jan van Hoof, who was 80 at the time of this visit. Would you describe what happens in this visit?
Well, what happened is that Mama, who was the alpha female and absolutely central figure of the whole colony there, she was dying. And Jan van Hoof, my professor, he decided to enter her night cage, which we normally never do. You never go in with an adult chimpanzee because they're far too dangerous and they're volatile and so on. But since he was dying and since he had known her, just like I have known her for 40 years, so was on very good terms with her, but had always visited her with bars in between, he decided to go in. And what's interesting is that apart from the response that she had a big grin on her face, and she embraced him and patted him on the back and things like that, was that she was reassuring him. She must have sensed, and this was typically Mama because she was a very sort of a calming figure in the colony. She must have sensed that Jan van Hoof was nervous and that it was extremely unusual situation, and so she calmed him down. And the thing that struck me is not so much that people were moved by the video, because it was first shown on national TV in Holland and then later on the internet. That people were moved was completely understandable. I was very moved by the whole thing. But that people were surprised how human-like the expression of Mama was and how human-like her gestures were. And that is something that struck me, as I thought, well, everyone knows that chimps are our closest relatives, so why wouldn't the way they express their emotions be extremely similar to ours? But people were surprised by that.
You know, it's really such a beautiful video because he's petting her and she's kind of petting him. She's stroking him. And when he walks in, she has this, like, you know, she's just been lying there expressionless with her eyes open. They look like the eyes of an animal that's dying. But when he walks in, like, I've never seen like a chimp smile like that. I mean, like, her whole face changes and her whole mouth just changes. So it really is beautiful. What was the nature of your relationship with Mama?
Oh, I was just as close. I didn't live as close as Jan, but because I live in the U.S. But each time I would show my face at the zoo, even if I was among hundreds of visitors, she would pick me out and she would come over to greet me from across the moat, because they live on an island most of the time. So I had a very close relationship with her, and she was actually not just a diplomat in her own group, because it's a very big chimp colony with 25 individuals and a lot of power struggles and stuff like that. But also she was a diplomat to the outside, to us humans who took care of them at the zoo. And so she maintained relationships with lots of people.
And you write that you had grooming sessions with her. Would you describe what happens in a grooming session between a human like you and a chimp like Mama?
Oh, they love to groom. Actually, you should be careful. If you have a little injury on your hand or your arm, they try to open it, because that's how they clean injuries on each other. And so and she likes to groom very small details, like the whimpers on your eyes and things like that. And so she would love to groom me, and I would groom her a little, and talk to each other and stuff like that. So yeah.
Tell me more about what the grooming means. Like, what are you doing to her, and what is she doing to you?
Grooming is mainly a social activity, especially for animals at zoos. So in the wild, of course, there are ectoparasites and there are ticks and things like that need to be removed. And so grooming has a major function. It's a very important behavior. But also in the wild, I would say that the grooming, they do more grooming than is strictly needed for hygiene, because it's a calming activity, both for the one who performs it and the one who receives it. And we have still leftovers of that when you go to the barber or the hairstylist, and that's a lot of grooming there. But in the chimps, it's very much a bonding ritual, and so it's used after fights to calm each other down. It's used to negotiate, like you may groom the alpha male to get certain favors from the so grooming is basically a service that you exchange. It's one of the many services that chimps exchange, because they have a lot of let's say a service economy going on among themselves.
So Mama had a roommate. I guess this was at night that they would go into cages. Like, describe the situation. Is that what it was?
Mama had a roommate, which her name was Kuif. And not only would they sleep together in the same cage at night, but in the daytime when they were in the colony with the other 25 chimps, they would also very often be together, because Kuif was basically the right-hand woman for Mama. And so they had a coalition, as we usually call it, and a very politically important one, because the males knew that if they had a fight with Mama, they had a fight with Kuif at the same time. So there was always the males knew that they were always dealing with two females there. And so when I would approach her night cage and try to have an interaction with Mama, Kuif would be there. But in the beginning, Kuif would always try to dominate me and take advantage of the fact that Mama was sitting there, her big supporter, and she would try to hit at me and things like that. Chimps always tried to get the upper hand. Mama didn't do that with me, but her friend tried to do that. And that whole attitude of Kuif changed 100% after I helped Kuif raise children, because Kuif had trouble with lactation. She didn't have enough milk production. And so she lost a few infants, and this was a terribly depressing time for her, and she would be crying and not eating. And she was extremely depressed by losing her infants. And at some point, I decided, since we had a baby chimp up for adoption, I decided to teach her how to bottle feed a baby. And so from that moment on, she adopted an infant that she raised on the bottle, and then she raised her own offspring. In the years after, she raised her own offspring also on the bottle.
How did you teach Kuif how to bottle feed her baby and the adopted baby that you gave her? And the adopted baby was from a female chimp who was deaf and had trouble raising her babies.
Yeah, so that female was deaf, and she had lost also a couple of babies because of her deafness and not responding well to the baby. And so we decided we were not going to have her had babies anymore. And that's why we handed it over to Kuif and taught her how to bottle feed. And the way we did that is that I kept the baby for 6 weeks, I believe, together with the caretaker, female caretaker. We together held that baby. And so for 6 weeks, we held it on our side, and we taught Kaif how to hold the bottle and feed it and to the baby, and that the baby would be suckling and all of that. And then after 6 weeks, we gave it to her. We put it in the straw of her cage, and she would find it there. And the funny thing was that in the beginning, she didn't want to take it. And that is, I think, because she considered it our baby, which is obvious because we had had it for 6 weeks. And in chimps, it's not very well regarded to take the baby of somebody else. And so she was extremely reluctant to even approach it. And she kept looking at us. And we kept saying, well, you go ahead and stuff like that. And at some point she approached the baby and she took it and she never left it from that moment on. So she adopted that baby chimp. And since that time, and I described that in my text as gratitude, I saw that as a sign of gratitude. She was extremely friendly with me. I was basically a family member. She never, ever struck out at me again after that time. And she was very much in favor always when I came, and always very sad if I left, because I had become part of her family, I think.
You popularized the term alpha male when using it to describe primate behavior. And what did you mean when you started using it?
Well, alpha male in my field just means the top male. You have the top male and the top female. You have only one of them. You cannot have two alpha males in a group of chimps or two alpha females. So it means the top individual. And the term comes out of wolf research. The wolf researchers, they use that term also just for the top male or the top female.
And you say sharing is a very important part of getting and maintaining alpha male power.
Yeah, the alpha male has many duties, I think, also. And an alpha male who keeps the peace in the group, a good alpha male breaks up fights and defends the underdog, not usually the winners, but the losers. And the alpha male also is the consoler-in-chief, goes to individuals after a fight to console the ones who have lost and sit with them and groom with them and hold them and things like that. And so the consoler-in-chief role is extremely important. And an alpha male who is good at that, he is also usually kept in power for longer. So in a chimpanzee society, you always have challengers to the top male. And it's almost as if the group is waiting. If the male is a bully that they don't like, they're almost waiting for that challenger, and they're going to put their weight behind him. And if it's a good alpha male that who keeps order and is protective and is not abusive, then they try to keep that male in power.
Let's talk about female power in the primate world. You've told us a little bit about female chimps and through the story of Mama. But bonobos in the wild, the alpha females are especially powerful. And you say it's usually a female that's in charge of the bonobo colony. How do female bonobos get and assert their power?
Yeah, so the bonobo is interesting that we have two close relatives, the chimpanzee and the bonobo. They're equally close to us, genetically exactly equally close. And so they're equally relevant, in my opinion, even though many anthropologists have preferred the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee is male-dominated, quite aggressive, has war going on between groups, basically, because they kill between groups. And the anthropologists have flocked to the chimpanzee and have ignored the bonobo because the bonobo is very sexy and peaceful and female-dominated, and they just don't know what to do with that. I don't know a single colony of bonobos in captivity that is not led by a female. And in the wild, we now know that most of the time also at the top of the hierarchy is females more than males. So the bonobo is a very female-dominated society. If you ask, how do these females get to the top? That's an interesting problem. I think in female chimps, like with Mama, or in female bonobos, age and personality are the main factors. And so there's actually very little open competition and politics going on the way it is among the males. It is if you wait long enough and you get old enough and you have a strong personality, you can be the alpha. In both bonobos and chimps, I very rarely see a sort of middle-aged female dominating these older females. If you have a group, let's say, with a few 25-year-old females and a few 40-year-old females, and the 40-year-olds really are physically not as strong long as the 25-year-olds, I can tell you, it's going to be the 40-year-old females who are at the top. That's a very different situation from the males. In the males, if you get too old, you get weaker and you're going to be kicked out of the top position.
I don't know if like female, if certain female chimps and certain female bonobos are perceived as being like more sexually attractive than others, but is there any correlation between like sex and power, or reproductive years and power?
In humans and in all species, this is very typical, is that a male, and this is universal, a male can increase his reproductive success, which is the driver of evolution. A male can increase it by mating with lots of partners. So a male chimpanzee who mates with 20 females, he can in principle have 20 babies. A female chimpanzee who mates with 20 males doesn't make any difference. She still gets one baby. And that's why the rules for males and females in reproduction are totally different. And the power structure reflects that, is that males often they try to reach the top position and that gives them mating privileges. For the females, I don't think that's the issue. It's mating privileges are not the issue. For female primates in general, what is the issue is food. They, in order to raise offsprings and to be successful at that, you need to gather enough food. And so there is competition among females. And in many primates, we find very intense competition among females, but it's usually about food. It's not about sex.
So another thing about primates, and I think this is true of all primates, you can correct me on this, but like they can mate, like and the female can have a child, but they don't form couple relationships. You know, the father doesn't become the father and the mother don't become a pair. So does the father take no responsibility for the baby?
I consider that actually the biggest difference between us humans and the two apes who are closest to us, chimps and bonobos. I know people always like to emphasize our intellectual capacities and language and stuff like that, but actually the fact that we form families, stable families with male-female offspring, is drastically different from what we see in the other apes. So In some of the primates, there are males involved in offspring care, but in our closest relatives, that's not the rule. And so a chimp male or a bonobo male, they do extremely little. And that's also why it all comes down to the female, and that's why the females have these very long interbirth intervals. And that means that a female bonobo or a female chimp, they get a baby about every 6 years. They cannot do more because at some point they shift their baby from the belly to the back, and at that point there's a place open at the belly, but they have to travel through the forest, through the trees, with these offspring clinging to them, and so they cannot have two offspring is just too many for them, and so that's why they have a long interbirth interval, and we have a shortened one. We can have one of 2 years, and that's all because males are involved in offspring care. So we have cooperative breeding, so females help each other. That's also very important. But on top of that, we have males being involved. And the human male actually is more inclined and more motivated and has hormonal changes when he has an offspring. So the human male is sort of predestined to be at least a little bit or sometimes a lot being involved in offspring care.
People who study animal behavior, students who study animal behavior, were always warned about anthropomorphism, which is when you attribute human characteristics to animals. Like saying, oh, he's so happy, or look, he's so sad. But you say that equally or perhaps even more dangerous is anthropodenialism. So compare the two for us, anthropomorphism and anthropodenialism.
So anthropomorphism is a term often slung at us when we propose that your dog is jealous or that chimpanzees may be attached to each other, or when you use human-like terminology, or they reconcile after fights. I was told actually for reconciliation to use post-conflict mouth-to-mouth contact because they kiss each other after fights. So they didn't want me to use the word reconciliation because it sounds too human-like. And I think for species that are close to us, like the primates, anthropomorphism is really not a big problem because we are primates, and so we should use the same terminology. We don't call the hand of a chimpanzee a front paw. No, we call it a hand because it is the same form, the same structure, the same bones as our hand. And so we should use the same terminology for structures that are similar, but also for behaviors that are similar. And if you, let's say, you tickle a chimpanzee and they produce laughing sounds, like type laughing sounds, you have to call it laughing. It is laughing. It is not vocalized panting, as people would want me to say. So I think anthropomorphism is not such a big deal with species that are close to us. And that's why I invented the word anthropodenial, which is the opposite, is that you deny that there are connections between humans and other species. And actually, entire areas in the university, like philosophy, anthropology, parts of psychology, they are in anthropodenial. They live in a way, they think that the human mind and the human spirit are so totally different, we cannot compare them with what a monkey or a dolphin or which other animal is doing. And so they are denying that connection, which I think is detrimental and is actually much more dangerous, in my opinion, because anthropodenial has a lot of negative side effects in my mind. It's much more dangerous than anthropomorphism.
What are some of the other side effects?
Well, one of them is we live at the moment in a time where we're destroying the planet. We humans are an ecological disaster, and entire species and large numbers of animals are disappearing, forests is disappearing, the globe is warming. And that is all a result, I think, of our attitude, is that we can do whatever we want with nature because we're not really part of nature. We're sort of outside nature, and since we're outside, we can do whatever we want. And I think that attitude is also reflected in how we look at other animals. And I think it's a very dangerous attitude not to think that we are part of it and we have to act responsibly within that framework.
Frans de Waal, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Frans de Waal is the author of the new book Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Jordan Peele has been busy since his feature film debut Get Out, which won him an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. His upcoming projects include a new streaming series based on The Twilight Zone, which debuts next month. He's the executive producer, as well as the host and narrator. But for now, he has a new horror picture in theaters called Us, which stars Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke as a couple on vacation with their kids. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Get Out was the definition of a hard act to follow, a critically adored, Oscar-winning smash hit that announced the actor and comedian Jordan Peele as a filmmaker to be reckoned with. It was also a searingly confrontational movie about the horrors of being black in America, a thriller that turned white liberal racism into the most insidious of boogeymen. The smart and relentlessly scary new thriller Us doesn't have anything quite that conceptually audacious up its sleeve, and that's a good thing. Peele isn't interested in repeating himself, and race, while hardly irrelevant here, isn't the chief source of tension this time around. His most radical gesture is to place an African-American family at the center of the action, with a matter-of-factness that we don't see enough of in mainstream movies. Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke, who shared a few scenes as fellow Wakandans in Black Panther, here play a married couple named Adelaide and Gabe Wilson. They're on summer vacation with their kids, Zora and Jason, in Santa Cruz, California, where they have a lakeside rental home and a beautiful beach just a few miles away. But something about that beach frightens Adelaide, triggering flashbacks to a strange, startling encounter she had there as a young girl in 1986, which left her traumatized for months afterward. What exactly happened to Adelaide, and why is it coming back to haunt her now, more than 30 years later? We'll find out soon enough. Us is a return of the repressed movie, and a scary doppelganger movie. It's like a George Romero zombie freakout, crossed with Invasion of the Body Snatchers. On the first night of their vacation, the Wilsons are greeted by the unnerving sight of four visitors, who appear to be near-identical versions of themselves, standing silently in their driveway. Gabe tries to communicate with them, but to no avail.
Okay, let's call the cops.
I did. They're 14 minutes away.
What? 14 minutes? Okay. Jason, give me the bat.
What bat? The baseball bat, the bat. There's one in the
corner. Here, here.
Thank you.
Gabe.
All right, hold on. I got this. Let's try this again.
Gabe.
No. All right.
Gabe.
I got this. Now, I thought I already done told y'all to get off my property, okay? So if y'all want to get crazy, we can get crazy.
The goofy dad humor in Winston Duke's delivery is a perfect example of Peele's tonal approach, his skill at balancing horror and hilarity. He reminds us that laughing, screaming, and thinking are not mutually exclusive pleasures. And he gives us plenty to think about once the doppelgangers force their way into the Wilsons' home and sit down with them around the fireplace, setting a long night of confrontation and terror in motion. As Adelaide's evil twin explains with chilling deliberation, each doppelganger is a shadow of sorts, a neglected, forgotten soul that has had no real life of its own until now. Each of them wields a set of very large, very sharp scissors, the purpose of which is not just to torture and kill, but also to sever the ties that bind the doubles to their masters. Peele has noted that Us was inspired by a classic episode of the original Twilight Zone series called Mirror Image, about a woman who meets her own double at a bus station. The movie takes that premise to a frightening new extreme by asking the question, what if the evil that dwells within took human form? What if we encountered our own worst enemy, and that enemy turned out to be us? But Peele doesn't belabor his conceit. Even more than Get Out, which built slowly to its gory climax, this is a full-throttle horror movie, packed with pulse-pounding chase scenes, beautifully timed jolts, and occasional geysers of blood. Peele's suspense technique has grown in confidence. The action is elegantly composed and sharply edited, and he shrewdly keeps the worst terrors just off-screen, letting our imaginations do the rest. He's also a marvelous director of actors. Elizabeth Moss gives a wickedly funny performance as a friend of the Wilsons, who has made the mistake of vacationing with her own family nearby. Shahadi Wright Joseph and Evan Alex are terrific as the Wilson children, and also as their menacing doubles. But Us belongs to Lupita Nyong'o, who won an Oscar for her wrenching work in 12 Years a Slave, and who carries this movie with a performance of astounding emotional force. It isn't just that Nyong'o is playing two roles, impressive as that is. She infuses Adelaide with so many distinct layers, from a survivor's lingering trauma to a mother's unshakable resolve. There isn't a moment when she doesn't have Us in her grip.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Us, the new horror film written and directed by Jordan Peele. Coming up, we talk with actor and writer Heidi Schreck. Her play, What the Constitution Means to Me, is about to open on Broadway. It's about when she was a teenager debating the Constitution in competitions and her later realization that the Constitution failed to protect four generations of women in her family. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Heidi Schreck, wrote and stars in a new play whose title is both serious and tongue-in-cheek, reflecting how the play itself is both serious and funny. It's called What the Constitution Means to Me. It's about what the Constitution used to mean to her when she was 15, winning prize money in Constitution contests, and what it means to her now as a feminist, realizing the ways in which women, people of color, and many immigrants were excluded from rights the Constitution guaranteed. When Schreck was 15, she competed in contests sponsored by the American Legion. Each contestant had to make a speech demonstrating their understanding of the Constitution and discuss its importance in his or her life. Schreck won enough money to put herself through college. In the show, she alternates between her 15-year-old self, who thought the Constitution was magical, and herself today, who sees the ways it's failed to protect many people. Shrek is a playwright and actress. She's also written episodes of the TV shows Billions, Nurse Jackie, and I Love Dick. Heidi Shrek, welcome to Fresh Air. I don't know if this is the right thing to say or not, but had we been good friends and you came to me and said, I'm going to do this, you know, show about the Constitution, I might have tried to talk you out of it, but I actually love the show. So I want you to describe the show in your words.
Sure. Yes, a few friends did try to talk me out of it, actually. So my show, What the Constitution Means to Me, is a recreation of a contest I did as a teenage girl. I would travel the country giving speeches about the Constitution for prize money at American Legion halls. Basically, I decided to follow the prompt of the original contest, which was to find a personal connection between my own life and the Constitution. And in attempting to do that, I ended up writing a story about four generations of women in my family, about how the Constitution shaped their lives, about the ways it failed to protect them, and about the ways it shaped my own life and also failed to protect me.
So your show is, you know, about like the strength of the Constitution. It's also very much about the imperfections of the Constitution, the silences and the absences in the Constitution and the people it fails to protect. But when you were 15 and participating in these Constitution debates or performances, was the understanding you were given by the American Legion that sponsored this competition that the Constitution was pretty much perfect and it was your job to like describe the ways in which it was perfect?
I don't know if that was the directive given to me by the American Legion or not. I actually don't remember that. I believe that it was my understanding of the Constitution. I believed that about the Constitution at 15. I believed it was perfect. I believed it was a tool of justice. I did not realize as a 15-year-old girl that how profoundly I had been left out of it. I didn't realize that it didn't protect me. The truth is, as a teenager, I just had complete faith in this document.
So one of the things that you talk about in the show is what the Constitution has to say about immigration, what it doesn't have to say about immigration, and who becomes a citizen. Your great-great-grandmother, you say, was considered a good immigrant when she came in 1879. Your great-great-grandfather actually ordered her from a catalog. She was a mail-order bride.
And yes,
he was in the state of Washington, where you were born and grew up. And you say Washington needed more women at the time. Why did they need more women?
They needed more women in Washington because the male-to-female ratio at the time was 9-1. In fact, at some points around this time, this was like the late 19th century, it was even higher. I think at one point it was even 30-1. So they were doing everything they could to bring in more women. There were a lot of catalogs. There was one called the Matrimonial Times, which is, I believe, where he ordered her from. Although I've tried to fact check it and it's a little bit tricky. He was German, so there were also a lot of like German language papers and catalogs and magazines with advertisements in the back that catered particularly to German immigrants. So
what would happen? Like women like your great-great-grandmother would go to the publisher of the catalog and say, put me in it. I want to be eligible to come to America as a bride.
Or their parents would do that. I think there were, in my research, I noticed that a lot of times it was parents who were poor and couldn't figure out, you know, what to do with their daughters who couldn't make money. So they would go and put an ad for their daughter.
Nice. Obviously, you never met your great-great-grandmother, but do you have any idea, passed on through family history, what it was like for her to come to America as a mail-order bride?
So I do have a little bit. So my great-grandma Bricken, who I did know, who died at, I believe, the age of 98, she knew my great-great-grandmother, and she said she remembered her locking herself in her room and refusing to come out, and that she had pasted newspaper articles, German newspaper articles, up all over her walls and would just sit in her room and sort of stare at these articles. So that's the story that was passed down to me. I also, we have the medical records from Western State Mental Hospital, which is where she eventually went, and she was diagnosed with melancholia, as it was called at the time, and died there at age 36. My great-grandma Bricken, however, also, she came from Sweden, and she talked a lot about what it was like for her to be an immigrant woman coming to Washington State, and she said when they were in Sweden, there were all these, I don't know, flyers and leaflets that, you know, urged people to come to America, that said the streets were paved with gold, and she always liked to joke that when she arrived, she discovered that the streets were paved with She said it was not at all what she expected.
Since President Trump has such strong anti-immigrant rhetoric and attitudes towards certain groups of people, like Mexicans, Muslims, I'm wondering what, you know, you've been studying this as an adult and as a teenager. What does the Constitution have to say about who becomes a citizen? And what is it silent about?
The Constitution doesn't have much to say about who becomes a citizen. So the 14th Amendment says that any person born on U.S. soil and subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a citizen of the United States and the state in which they reside. So it does. It is very clear on birthright citizenship, excuse me, although it also has this clause, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which is what the government used to exclude indigenous peoples from becoming citizens when the 14th Amendment was passed. So that's a little bit confusing, but most legal scholars have come down on the side of birthright citizenship, that that is a constitutional right, which, as we know, was questioned by the Trump administration last year. Most people agree that there's no question about that. Birthright citizenship is our right. Beyond that, it doesn't give any guidance about immigration, about how many people should be allowed to immigrate, about where those people might be from. There's no language about that. The one thing I did learn while making this is that the 14th Amendment does guarantee that immigrants be given all the due process rights that citizens have. So it uses the word person rather than citizen when it talks about due process, which is the right to a fair trial, which is the right not to be imprisoned without a fair trial, the right not to have anything seized from you. So there are quite a few protections for immigrants in the 14th Amendment that I question right now whether those are being upheld.
I think a lot of people have no idea that people who aren't citizens would still have those rights.
I don't think so either. And, you know, there's also in the, I believe it was the 80s, I might be getting this wrong, the Supreme Court also upheld the right of children of undocumented immigrants to attend public school. That's also a case that was decided. So immigrants have actually quite a few rights under our Constitution, even if they are undocumented. And I think it's an important time to remember that and fight for that.
So I want to get back to your family. Your great-great-grandmother came here basically as a mail order bride. She came from Germany to the state of Washington. Your great-grandmother and your grandmother were both married to men who abused them. Your grandmother, Betty, who you knew very well, her first husband died in an accident. He was hit by a falling tree. She remarried a man who physically abused her, who beat her up, who broke bones. And the stepfather, her second husband, also sexually abused your mother and your aunt. And you say it was your mother who finally called the police and tried to stop this. How old were you when your mother told you this?
I was 15 years old when my mother told me this. I also just want to say my aunt was very brave in terms of she went to a teacher, and she also testified and was very brave about standing up to this man. So it was both my mother and my aunt.
How old was your mother when she called the police?
My mother was 14 years old.
So when your mother told the police and her stepfather found out, what was his reaction?
His reaction was to essentially threaten all the kids with a gun, to kidnap them and drive off, shouting that he was going to kill all of them.
So he actually put them in a car, took his gun,
yes,
and drove off.
Yes.
And then your grandmother called the police, and they came.
Yes.
And he was prosecuted. He did 10 years?
He was prosecuted. He actually, okay, so this has been very interesting for me because I was told a version of the story, and then there's the version of the story I remembered. When I did an interview for the New Yorker magazine, they were able to fact check everything. And I actually found out that he was sentenced to 3 consecutive 30-year sentences for what was termed at that time carnal knowledge, but that he only served 2 years.
So how does this physical and sexual abuse in your family connect to your understanding of the Constitution?
So I grew up believing in the idea of one bad man. There was a bad man in our family who hurt my grandma, hurt my aunts and uncles, deeply hurt my mom. So I grew up believing that there was one bad man who hurt my family, who hurt the women in my family. And it wasn't until later, really until I started researching this, that I began to understand this problem as part of a larger cultural problem, a legal problem, a systemic problem. And in working on this, I ended up researching the 14th Amendment quite deeply, and I learned that there are no constitutional protections for women against sexual violence. And that, in fact, the Violence Against Women Act was essentially gutted by the Supreme Court in 2005 when a woman named Jessica Gonzalez brought her case in front of the Supreme Court. She was suing the Castle Rock Police Department of the state of Colorado for failing to show up to protect her from her violent husband. She had a restraining order against her violent husband. She called the police many, many times. No one came to help her. They refused to come help her. They said, well, he's your husband. And her husband ended up killing her children, her 3 daughters. And when she took her case to the Supreme Court essentially said, you can't sue the police department. They have no constitutional obligation to provide you with active protection. Some legal scholars have said this shuts down the 14th Amendment for women. It shuts down the possibility for women to look to the federal government for protection from gender-based violence. So when I realized that this trauma in my family wasn't just one bad man, one evil man, but a legal and systemic problem in this country, it was eye-opening for me.
You were already working on your play, What the Constitution Means to Me, during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. What was your experience of watching Christine Blasey Ford testify to, you know, to the Senate Judiciary Committee?
I remember sitting on the couch watching that, being, I think like many of us, where I felt like an emotional wreck. I found her testimony incredibly powerful. I believed her. I also found it triggering. I think a lot of people did. It reminded me of things that happened to me when I was younger. And I cried a lot while watching it. And then I had to go do a show. And when I got to the theater, I was exhausted. And I thought, well, that was actually a big mistake, because now I'm exhausted and I have to do this show. But I found when I walked on stage, well, first of all, I had so much rage that sort of gave me the adrenaline I needed to do the show. And then it was also quite powerful to be in a room filled with people who were processing the same thing I was processing. There was a tremendous amount of energy in the room that night, a tremendous amount of audible reaction, both to the humor and tremendous amount of audible grief, particularly from women. And I thought, thank God I get to do this show instead of sitting home on my couch scrolling through Twitter in despair. And that has been one of the great gifts of the show, actually, is to be in a room with people having a communal experience, thinking about our country together, having this conversation together, instead of being siloed, instead of being alone at home on social media. It's one of the great gifts of the show for me.
So the show you were doing was the show you're doing now,
the Constitution
show. It was this
show, What the Constitution Means to Me, yeah. I will say I ended up in a room with Brett Kavanaugh, which was very strange. I was invited to a dinner in Washington with my 17-year-old debate partner, Thursday Williams. Thursday and I were at a dinner, and Brett Kavanaugh was sitting at a table close to us. And I really, well, it was, Thursday said to me, do you want to go meet him? And I said, no, I don't. And she went over, and this amazing 17-year-old young woman went over and introduced herself, said she was Thursday Williams, that she was starring in a play on Broadway about the Constitution and women's bodies, and that he needed to come see it.
That's interesting. She plays your debate partner at the end
of
the show.
She's my debate partner. Yeah. She is my debate partner. She's not playing anything. She's she's one of the fiercest debaters I've ever competed against.
Well, Heidi Schreck, good luck with the show.
And thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Heidi Schreck wrote and stars in the play What the Constitution Means to Me. It opens on Broadway at the Helen Hayes Theater at the end of the month. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.